Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking all our source material, all these notes, narratives, internal monologues, and we're going to get right to the heart of a single incredibly complex character.
Yeah, we're doing a deep, deep character study on the woman known in the sources as Anna.
And this isn't just a simple profile. It really feels more like we're, I don't know, excavating a series of contradictions.
It's an anatomy of paradox, really. Mm. The sources give us this incredibly rare, unfiltered look inside her head. And what you find is just wow.
Right.
On the surface, you have this hyper-competent scholar. We're talking valedictorian, magna cum laude, who comes across as ice cold.
So reserved.
Yeah.
Almost aggressively so.
Exactly. But then you start to peel back those layers and you realize that this fortress she's built, it's all defensive.
It's hiding something else entirely.
It's hiding this deep-seated insecurity, a capacity for just ferocious loyalty, and this is the most surprising part, a really intimate spiritual life that basically anchors her entire turbulent world.
So our mission today is to go beyond just, you know, listing those traits. We need to actually unpack them. Mm-hmm. We want to figure out how the pressure of being this brilliant academic from a school like Ateneo could lead to such intense self-protection.
Okay.
And how her deep fear of abandonment manifests in these really manipulative tactics in her relationships.
Yeah, she's constantly fighting this internal war. The material we've gathered, you know, the excerpts about her fiery connection with Chris, her memories of Iloquois Norte, those moments of just desperate internal bargaining, mm-hmm. It all shows a woman trying so hard to map out a perfectly safe future, even as her own emotions are threatening to just detonate every single plan she makes.
Well, and that's why her journey is such a powerful mirror. I mean, for anyone grappling with that gap between public success and private vulnerability.
That's a great way to put it.
We're not just looking at a high achiever here.
Mm.
We're examining someone who built her success as a protective shield against the world.
So to understand Anna.
To understand Anna, you have to understand how that shield was forged. And then ultimately, how the most important part of her life, her faith, forces her to just drop it.
Okay, so let's unpack this. To really understand her, we have to start where the world starts with her.
Her immediate presence.
Exactly. Her striking physical and psychological presence. Even in a small town like Bangui, she stood out, but not because she was trying to.
No, not at all. The sources immediately jump to her physical description. They call her a very attractive Morena beauty.
Which, for our listeners, is a reference to a stunning Filipina beauty, right?
Yeah.
Characterized by that rich, naturally tan skin and dark features.
Exactly. She has this natural radiance that just makes her instantly memorable.
But the physical feature that everyone seems to remember, the one that really defines her interactions, it's not her smile. It's not her elegance.
No. It's the sheer force of her gaze.
Her eyes.
Yes. Her eyes are described as piercing, deep, and unnerving. This is not some gentle, dew-eyed look.
No. It's a look that makes you, and this is a quote, feel real conscious.
And she uses that gaze. Whether it's conscious or just instinct, she uses it to evaluate, to challenge, and let's be honest, to intimidate.
It's a power move.
It's an immediate power move, yeah. But it's disguised as just simple observation.
And what makes that so compelling is the contrast with how she dresses. She's not dressing for attention.
Not in the slightest. She wears a simple Ateneo shirt, white denim shorts, sneakers. It's all very casual, functional.
Deliberately understated. She has this elite academic status, but she refuses to wear it like a status symbol.
Exactly. Her intent is clearly to deflect attention. She wants to be seen for her mind, not her appearance. She wants to blend in, or at least not invite that kind of superficial scrutiny.
But her natural presence just completely sabotages that effort.
Totally. It creates fascinating tension, where her deliberate attempt to minimize her impact only serves to amplify it.
And the best description of this tension, it has to be from Chris, the first time he sees her. He doesn't see a girl in simple clothes. He sees something else entirely.
Oh, he's absolutely floored. He describes her internally as sleek and exotic, like a Ferrari. You just had to look and take another look.
A Ferrari. Think about that comparison.
It's perfect, right? A Ferrari is a machine built for power, speed, absolute exclusivity.
And she's embodying that, this high-performance, high-status object, even though she's dressed like she's going to a study session.
That gap right there between her intent to be invisible and her effect to be impossible to ignore, That's the first major contradiction we see in her personality.
It really sets the standard for everything else. Everything she does with this quiet intensity, even when she's trying to be low-key. So, okay, let's move from that physical shell to the immediate psychological barrier she puts up. The source material labels it an outwardly Scorpio personality.
And that label, it just speaks volumes about her defense strategy.
How so?
The initial impression she gives most people is reserved, unfriendly, and often just outright cold. She uses this frigid exterior as her first line of defense.
Defense against what?
Against the assumption that she's easily approachable or that she needs anything from anyone.
But this coldness is tactical, isn't it? It's not who she is all the time.
Oh, no. It's a switch she can flip.
So she's calculating.
She's absolutely calculating. She's deciding who deserves access to her warmth and who has to be kept at arm's length. The coldness is deployed against anyone she sees as a threat to her boundaries or just irrelevant to her goals.
And when she meets Chris, that defensive barrier goes up instantly. It becomes an aggressive challenge.
Immediately. He tries to make small talk, you know, suggests she looks out of place in this provincial town.
And she doesn't hesitate for a second.
No, she fires back with the exact counter challenge. Maybe you look out of place, not me.
That's not just an answer. That's a declaration of war in a way.
It is. She establishes right away that she is fierce, in your face, and she will not concede ground, especially not to men who try to patronize her or define her context for her.
Let's go back to the unnerving gaze for a moment, because she uses it as a specific tactic.
A very repeatable tactic, yeah. It's to establish dominance in social settings. She sees these interactions as a hierarchy, and she is determined to be at the top.
So the silent, unblinking staring.
It's to gain the upper hand. She's not just staring to be mysterious. She's using it to gather information, to read their motivations.
And to basically force the other person to break eye contact or start talking defensively.
Exactly. And she dismisses the men who try to flirt with her as stupid boys.
That judgment, it lets her justify using intimidation. It's a mechanism to make sure she won't be dismissed or categorized or, most importantly, hurt.
She is setting the parameters of her own safety through sheer force of will and a very intimidating silence.
So the way she carries herself, the striking looks, the simple clothes, the challenging gaze, it's all carefully constructed armor.
It's a warning sign to everyone. It says, I am smarter than you think, I am tougher than you think, and I will be controlling this interaction.
And that first encounter with Chris is a perfect example. It's a high-stakes chess match where she's testing his defenses and her own ability to maintain that psychological high ground.
Absolutely. And this foundational tenacity, this just refusal to back down, it's what makes her intellectual journey so crucial to who she is. It's not just a list of accomplishments.
No, it's the blueprint for how she learned to survive.
Right. So we need to dive into the scale of your academic achievements because they are not just impressive. They are the strategic outcome of a deep, deep need to overcome being marginalized and to secure her future.
She is, I mean, let's be frank, academically elite. Valedictorian in high school, graduates magna cum laude from the Ateneo de Manila University.
And for anyone who doesn't know the context, Ateneo is one of the most prestigious and historically most socially exclusive universities in the Philippines.
It's a colossal status marker.
But here's the detail that makes her story so powerful. She didn't get there on family money.
She got the merit scholarship.
Which means her entire elite education was free. Plus, she got a stipend for living expenses. She didn't just attend this institution. She conquered it purely on intellectual merit. She forced her way into a social world that would have otherwise shut her out.
And she was the perfect academic machine. Class president, head of the debate team, honorary member of all these prestigious guilds.
But if you dig into the backstory, that success wasn't driven by a pure love of learning. It was self-defense.
You see that conflict right away. Her wealthier, big city classmates called her promdi.
A really dismissive term. It means from the province. And that label wasn't just a casual slight. It was an attempt to keep her on the margins.
While they were focused on socializing in dollhouses.
Anna realized she had only one weapon.
Her brain.
Exactly. She decided to channel all that negative energy, all that scorn, into the one thing she could control, her academic output. She concentrated on my studies.
And her grades weren't just good. They were flawless.
Yeah.
Creating this undeniable, objective shield against any of that socioeconomic scorn.
She forced them to respect her through sheer intellectual force. It's the definition of the survivor's forge. When the world uses your circumstances to belittle you, you have to overachieve to a degree that just makes those criticisms irrelevant.
So her magna cum laude title wasn't just a diploma.
No, it was proof. It was proof that she had outclassed the very people who tried to look down on her.
And that intense resilience, that willingness to fight, it was cemented by a moment of catastrophic abandonment in Manila.
Yeah, the sudden death of her aunt. Her aunt was her anchor in the city, and suddenly she's terrifyingly alone. And that moment could have broken her.
But her mother's response.
Her mother's response became the guiding principle for her entire life.
She didn't coddle her. She offered this creed of tough love that Anna completely internalized.
Life will test you, hurt you, and make you cry. But remember, these tests are gifts, a chance to be strong and independent.
Let's just dissect that for a second. It's so vital. Anna spends 3 days crying in her dorm room. She's consumed by this feeling of being a victim of total abandonment,
which is compounded by her father leaving for sea when she was young.
Right. And her mother's words offer a complete psychological reframing. The pain isn't something to run from. It's a catalyst.
The loss of her aunt, the absence of a safety net, it becomes paradoxically the gift of independence.
And that's the psychological turning point that defines her tenacity. The very next morning, she walks into class. She's made this singular, non-negotiable decision to embrace her new life path.
That's the moment she decided, I am a tough survivor who doesn't back down from fights.
But that tenacity isn't just for her own benefit. Even after reaching this elite status in Manila, she has this fierce, almost burdensome loyalty to her origins.
Po Bangui, yeah.
Yeah.
She felt compelled to make the townsfolk proud. She wanted to be seen as their finest daughter.
So her success carried the emotional weight of her whole community's hopes.
Right. She felt accountable not just to herself, but to her roots.
But as we mentioned earlier, this fierce tenacity, it often curdles into spite, even cruelty, when she feels challenged or threatened.
That line between fierce defense and unwarranted aggression is often very blurry for Anna.
You see that toxicity pop up immediately in her verbal sparring with Chris. When he pushes her or trash talks her, she doesn't use simple insults.
No, she weaponizes her hard-won academic status against his weaknesses.
She unleashes that cutting comment about him not graduating from LaSalle. Whatever happened to you, she says. She's implying he failed the journey she so successfully navigated.
And she knows exactly what she's doing. She knows that by bringing up his academic failure, she's hitting him right where his own insecurity is. It guarantees maximum emotional injury.
And this capacity for cruelty, it gets amplified later with Michael.
Right, who she genuinely cares for. She sees him as a misunderstood friend who just wants to help. Her loyalty is strong enough that she fiercely defends him against Chris's accusations.
Yet, when Michael resists her, when he defies her control and refuses to abandon his revolutionary path,
her tenacity pivots to emotional devastation. She inflicts extreme cruelty on him, just crushing his emotional attachment to her.
And then, crucially, she slips away before he wakes up. She prioritizes her future, her carefully planned academic track, above any emotional commitment she made to him.
And that reveals the core pattern we talked about. Her loyalties are real, but they are always secondary to maintaining her carefully constructed path to success.
So when loyalty requires her to risk her independence or her future,
she is willing to inflict tremendous, painful cuts on others, and often on herself, too, just to maintain that security. Her tenacity is a double-edged sword. It wins her awards, but it costs her intimacy.
Okay, so now we move to the interior landscape. If the exterior is the tough survivor, then the interior is a minefield of overthinking, secrecy, and this desperate, constant need for control.
Her defining internal trait is secrecy. And that is fundamentally a self-protection mechanism.
She actively shuts people out.
To avoid vulnerability, and by extension, to avoid getting hurt. If people don't know what she truly feels, they can't exploit it, and they can't abandon it.
And that secrecy is rooted so deeply in those triple traumas of abandonment you mentioned. Her father leaving, her aunt dying, her mother leaving her alone in Manila.
Exactly. Those events taught her that dependency leads to pain. So to protect herself from that catastrophic feeling of abandonment, she has to be the one controlling the emotional distance at all times.
And this plays out in her communication style. She speaks in subtext.
Constantly. She rarely says what she truly means. She will actively deny having feelings for Chris or deny being hurt by his behavior, even when her actions, her jealousy, her explosive reactions betray her completely.
She wants to be emotionally illegible.
Right. To prevent anyone from gaining leverage through genuine intimacy.
And this is where the control freak mechanism really kicks in. If she can't be honest about her feelings, she has to control the environment and the other person's reactions. She sees her interactions, especially with Chris, as a sophisticated chess game.
She is constantly running analysis. She's not just reacting. She's reading why I do this, studying why I do that. It's this relentless, exhausting mental exercise where she's trying to anticipate his moves, stay three steps ahead.
For Anna, vulnerability is just, it's poor strategy.
And control is the only guaranteed security.
We see a perfect, if a little petty, example of this need for vindictive control when Chris stands her up for a date. She doesn't just get mad and forgive him.
No, she devises this complex punishment that serves absolutely no purpose other than demonstrating her power over him.
That's the famous Pasukin anecdote.
It is. She demands he drive to Pasukin an hour away on a completely pointless errand. The distance, the inconvenience, the sheer absurdity of it.
It's all designed to prove that she can still manipulate his time and his energy even after he disappointed her.
And she confesses internally with this real satisfaction that when he agrees to go, it was exactly what I wanted to hear. It's pure vindictive control. It shows that she dictates the terms of reconciliation.
And that control extends into pure psychological warfare, what we'd recognize today as emotional manipulation or gaslighting.
Oh, absolutely. She consciously twists conversations to ensure she is never held accountable for her own emotional statements.
The prime example is after she confesses she only wants Chris as a summer fling when he tries to pin her down on that.
She immediately pivots. She denies ownership of her own statement. She argues that he is the one suggesting a fling.
That's what you're suggesting. I simply made a metaphor.
That denial is masterful because it throws Chris completely off balance. Suddenly, he has to defend his interpretation of her words rather than hold her accountable for the vulnerability in her confession.
So she retains the emotional high ground by creating cognitive confusion. She's using language not to connect, but as a weapon to maintain control of the narrative.
And why? Why this constant manipulation? Because she is intensely, almost destructively, driven by her emotions. The control is necessary to contain the feeling.
But when the feelings become too powerful, she explodes.
She does. We see the self-destructive potential on the hillside when she gets drunk and have that emotional meltdown. She is absolutely consumed by the chaos and fear of the situation with Chris and Michael and her future.
And in a moment of raw honesty, she cries out her deepest need. She needs just love.
That's the ultimate moment of vulnerability. It's the truth she's been trying to bury under academic plaques and control games.
But immediately after this profound confession, the fear of that vulnerability comes rushing back, and she self-sabotages. She violently pushes Chris away, instantly rejecting the very love she just begged for. Her emotional intensity is so overwhelming that it leads her to destroy the very thing she's seeking.
And this internal struggle is just. It's fed by her tendency to overthink, overanalyze, and catastrophize every possible outcome.
Her brain is constantly running worst-case scenarios, and it often links current challenges right back to those core abandonment fears.
You see her instant panic when Chris is late, fearing he's left her, or her extreme anxiety about Michael's potential retaliation after their conflict.
For Anna, small setbacks aren't just inconveniences. They trigger the catastrophic fear of everything falling apart, the exact fear she developed when she found herself alone in Manila.
This anxiety even invades her deepest spiritual moments. During a moment of intense prayer in the church, her need for certainty just overrides her faith.
Right. She starts demanding answers from God. Why are you allowing this? I don't understand. She's panicking about losing the future I'd been building for myself. Which reveals that her relationship with the divine is, at times, a desperate negotiation to get back control over her highly structured life plan.
But, and this is a huge but, this complex, controlling, and manipulative inner psyche is balanced by one saving grace in her human relationships.
Her loyalty.
Her intense loyalty and devotion to those she cares about the most. It's a contradiction, but it's undeniably real.
The sources show this devotion really beautifully when she takes Chris around Bangui. She introduces him to the honest, simple, good people of her hometown, like Manang Aring and Manang Ariel.
And this isn't just a tour. It's an attempt to share a piece of her soul and, critically, to genuinely help Chris overcome his corrosive cynicism.
She wants him to see this something very good that she values so deeply in her roots.
It shows a real desire for true emotional connection and a devotion to his well-being that just completely contradicts her gaslighting tendencies.
And her loyalty to Michael, despite his flaws, is also unwavering at first. She sees him as a friend who just wants to help the poor, overlooking his radicalism.
And that loyalty puts her in real physical danger later. When Chris is beaten by Michael's gang, she ignores her own safety. She steps in to confront the insurgents, demanding answers and protecting Chris.
This ability to put herself at risk for those she loves is a counterbalance to her self-protective cruelty.
So she isn't simply a villain or a victim. She's this complex tapestry woven from deep abandonment trauma, massive intellectual achievement used as a shield, and a profound, yet often misused, capacity for loyalty.
But all of this, the good and the destructive, it all revolves around her core.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here's where it gets really interesting. If the intellectual achievements were her shield and the control was her weapon, then her relationship with God is her operating system. It is the ultimate framework that dictates her resilience and, eventually, her clarity.
And that relationship is defined by its intimacy. You can see it in the specific name she uses.
She doesn't call him God in a formal, distant sense.
No. She calls him Papa God and my dearest friend. And that nomenclature, it immediately signals a deeply personal, intimate, comforting bond. This isn't institutional religion. This is direct, immediate companionship.
And this intimate faith wasn't just a side project for her. It was her fundamental structure during her periods of profound isolation.
When she was alone at her graduation, the sources note that he was her only companion. The quote is, "He was all I ever had." He was the bedrock during her isolation and crippling fear in Manila after her aunt died.
This relationship is where the complexity of Anna truly lies. It's the only place she allows herself to be truly vulnerable.
Although, even here, as we noted earlier, her human desire for control leads her to demand answers rather than just trust.
But the turning point for Anna comes when her emotional system finally breaks down. That hillside meltdown, the desperate negotiation in the church, when she loses all intellectual and emotional control.
Her dearest friend intervenes. And it's with this profound moment of clarity.
It's a moment of pure grace. In response to all her chaos and fear, the divine response just cuts through all her analyses and control games.
And the message is so simple. My dearest Anna, do you love him?
Mm.
So love him, for he's a gift I have sent to you.
That moment is, it's tectonic. It's permission to set aside her intellectual fear, to stop analyzing the consequences, and to simply embrace the emotional gift that's standing right in front of her.
Yes.
It tells her that her life is not just about structure, it's about acceptance and grace.
And this divine clarity, it also triggers a crucial self-critique about her academic success. Through this spiritual reflection, she looks at her greatest achievement, her magna cum laude plaque.
And she realizes it was a hollow plaque embellished with just my name.
That phrase, hollow plaque, is just devastatingly insightful. It means she realized that a decade of dedication, the success she used as her shield against that PromD label.
It was meaningless.
It was an ornament glorifying only myself. Her high achievement was empty because it was rooted in fear, not in purpose or in love.
And that realization shifts her internal calculus completely. Her future calling wasn't to get more awards or more control.
No, it was to move beyond self-aggrandizement. The moment she realizes her external validation is hollow is the moment she begins the agonizing process of finding internal worth anchored in something unshakable.
This conviction becomes her ultimate guiding principle, her new source of confidence against the cynicism and fear that had crippled her before.
Even after the chaos of that summer, she comes to this unwavering belief, I now know I deserve and will ultimately get only good things because I know God wants to give me only what is good.
But this faith is tested immediately and brutally.
Oh, by real-world catastrophe. After that intense summer, the sources show her subsequent path was just heartbreakingly difficult. The communists retaliated for the clashes.
And her store, which represented her new independence, was completely destroyed.
And most tragically, she lost her mother to cancer. And she connects this loss directly to her failure to get enough money for adequate treatment. She says her job became intensely personal because she was fighting to save her mother's life and failing.
This series of losses drives her to her lowest point. The survivor is finally broken.
She reaches a crisis of faith and will.
Mm-hmm.
She's ready to give up
mm-hmm.
and end it all. She is at the absolute precipice.
But then the divine intervention returns. Not through some grand miracle.
No, but through a simple, undeniable fact of life.
The birth of her son, Julius, This one simple occurrence realigned her entire existence. It shifted her focus from trying to control a lost future to cherishing the present, meaningful purpose of motherhood.
The pain of the past was leveraged into a completely new, unconditional love.
And the birth of her son provides her final, true clarity. In prayer, she finally acknowledges all the flaws that we've been talking about, the fear, the doubt, the capacity for hatred and manipulation.
I took everything you gave me for granted. I lived in fear, I swam in doubt, I learned to hate.
But the constant unconditional love from her Papa God remained, and it enabled her to finally learn how to truly love herself, moving past the trauma and fear that had dictated her life for so long.
The external achievement is permanently replaced by internal self-worth anchored in grace.
So Ana Raimundo, she's the ultimate learner, not just of books, but of the brutal, complex lessons of life.
She used her incredible intellect to build a wall of success, only to realize that the wall was flimsy and hollow unless it was matched by internal goodness, self-acceptance, and, critically, faith.
Her resilience isn't found in avoiding pain. She endured immense loss, betrayal, physical danger, heartbreak.
No, her resilience is rooted in the eventual surrender of control, in holding on to that dearest friend who provides unconditional love. And that's what allowed her to step out of the crippling fear and paralyzing doubt.
And finally, use her tenacity for a positive purpose.
Not
survival and motherhood.
Right. And the epilogue confirms her final status. She achieved the professional zenith she was always chasing. She's working for the UN in New York, raising her son, Julius.
Who is Chris's son, a fact he learns later. She is independent. She is strong.
And she achieved that strength not by controlling her environment, but by rejecting the fear that had governed all her choices.
Mm.
She followed the difficult instruction of her mother and the gentle guidance of her faith.
And this journey of separation and self-reclamation, it brings us back to a really profound realization.
Mm.
Anna's story shows that sometimes the greatest acts of love or self-love are not these grand public gestures.
No, they're difficult decisions made in silence to secure necessary distance.
In a moment of anger, she projected her internal chaos onto Chris. She told him, "The Philippines is not broken. You are broken."
Which is so telling.
It is. So we have to ask ourselves, you know, as we face our own deepest challenges, financial stress, relationship turmoil, whatever it is, when we feel broken, do we follow Anna's initial path?
Do we project that brokenness outward onto the people or the systems around us?
Or do we finally follow her true path and face the dearest friend within that core belief, that core strength, to find the true, unshakable power necessary to heal?